Okay. I've got still a whole lot of questions to do, and we'll see how that goes. But I was asked to start right on the dot at 8 o'clock, and it's still got a couple minutes, and the reason is for the recordings. So I'll wait with the questions, and just in the meantime, ask you if you have ever wondered why one who is skilled in goodness has to be told to be not proud and demanding and to be humble. If you're already skilled in goodness, then you should already be straightforward and gentle in speech and so forth. And I know there's a couple Pali nerds like me here. I'm not the only one. There's a handful of others. And this translation of the Metta Sutta, although it's chanted in Thai forest tradition, has a couple of issues with it. And actually, it doesn't mean this is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness, but it means this is what should be done by one who is skilled in the meaning of the Buddha's teachings. The atta means the meaning. It basically means somebody who understands the Buddha's teachings, the meaning of those teachings. That is what it means. It doesn't mean goodness. So somebody who understands the meaning of the Buddha's teachings and who knows the path of peace actually means, and who knows the state of peace or the figurative place of peace, so who understands Nibbana. So this actually, in my understanding, refers to the stream winners. They understand the meaning of the Buddha's teaching and they understand Nibbana. However, it can also be practiced by anybody else, of course. But that is just a little technical detail that I thought I would tell you just to fill up 2 minutes, which I have now done. And it's exactly 7. Okay. So now the recording should be ready. Dear Venerable, my progress with breathing meditation seems to be stuck at the stage of the breath slowing down and the feeling of arms and legs reducing, so your body disappearing, your breath slowing down. I do not, however, experience the joy arising. Please advise what I am missing. Okay, so you're going into some of these stages of meditation on the breath, when the breath starts to slow down and your body starts to disappear. Excellent. Excellent. Very well done. You're finding some peace there, I hope. Now you are asking how to take it further, because after the breath slows down, the Buddha said to experience the joy, the piti and sukha, he called it, of the meditation. And at that stage of the meditation, that piti and sukha, for those who know those terms, are sort of experienced as one thing. It's like the joyful bliss, the joyful happiness, as it were, the piti and the sukha. And sometimes that comes very automatically in meditation, but sometimes you might help it along a little bit if you're stuck in that stage. But before I tell you how to sort of help it along, the most important thing to do if you are missing joy in your meditation, but also joy in your life, is to not only follow the last factors of the Eightfold Path about meditation, but practice the whole Eightfold Path. Practice your precepts, your good behavior, your generosity. And if you do that, you'll become a more joyful person. And this lays the basis for meditation. The Buddha said that joy comes from sila, from virtuous behavior. It's the Pali word, sila means like good behavior. From that you get the joy, and from that joy you get the samadhi. It's like a sequential steps. And if you leave out the bottom step, if you start with trying to get samadhi and the meditation, and you leave out that step of virtue, then you might lack that joy that is necessary to take the mind deeper. So that is something to practice in your whole life. And I know many of you do that already, probably all of you. And you might still ask, I do that already, but still I don't feel that joy. I am generous, I am a good Buddhist, I go to meditation retreats, etc. And then sometimes it's helpful to do some of those contemplative practices to get that joy a bit stronger. Like, don't only do generous things, but sometimes also in meditation reflect upon those generous things you've done and see if that makes you happy. Remember the time that you did this thing for that person. For example, while I'm saying this, I remember this time I was in the Abu Dhabi airport, and there was this old Middle Eastern man, and he had this bag, and he had to carry it up into the airplane. And we didn't share any languages, so I just pointed at the bag, and I pointed at me. I only had that little bag that I showed you earlier, so that was all I had with me and my bowl. So I said, I carry it, and I carry it up the airplane, because we had to take the stairs. And in the top of the airplane, he said something like, Allah praise you, or something in Arabic, or I don't know exactly what it was, but that just makes me so happy to reflect on that small kind of thing. And that uplifts your mind. So reflect upon those things sometimes. And you can even do that actively in meditation practice. You can reflect upon the Buddha, Dhamma, Sangha, if that makes you happy, and reflect upon spiritual friends and all those things to create that joy. And at some point you become really skilled at just finding joy whenever you want to. Thich Nhat Hanh, a teacher that I followed when I was a layperson, said a skilled practitioner can find joy whenever they want to. They can just give rise to it, just like that. And in meditation, that is also the case. Sometimes you might be meditating and you say your breath is not joyful. It's calm, but it's not taking off. Then what you can do is invigorate that joy. Another way to do that is really be happy with the breath. Wow, breathing in, breathing out. This is so cool. The Buddha did this, and now I'm doing it myself. Wow, awesome. Have metta to the breath as well. Loving kindness to the breath. And if you show kindness to the breath will show kindness back to you, and it'll be so much more pleasant to look at. All those things. Maybe. In one of the other guided meditations that we still have, I will do a little bit of that. If life is suffering, why choose to start a family? With metta. Well, are you asking me? I didn't start a family. I don't know. I would say my choice is not to do it, obviously. But you can look at it in different ways. Maybe you're asking, I started a family. What have I done? Maybe that's the intent of this question. Well, life may be suffering, but some lives are more suffering than others. And if you raise your children nice and properly, and you raise them as good people, then they have good opportunity to make the most out of this life. And then you're actually giving them a great chance to maybe even become Buddhist if they feel like that, and do the same kind of teachings, follow the same kind of teachings you're doing the same kind of meditation, and then that's actually a lot of good merit and good karma to do that for those people. So in that sense, it's a very good thing to do. I'm going to answer the questions a bit more shortly than I did yesterday because of this. It doesn't look that bad, actually, when you just put them over there. But it's still a lot, so. Maybe a little bit less stories. Dear Sunyo, that's me. Thank you for the funny and wise stories. I don't know about that. And meditations. My favorite is the one about the egg and frying pan. I made that up at the spot, actually, so that's pretty cool. My peaceful meditation keeps getting interrupted by thoughts of a neighbor I have had conflict with. To put it simply, she seems to loathe me, and I have tried to be nice and make friends, but to no avail, and I feel very uncomfortable that she hates me. Any advice? You must live next to the angry crocodile. Just think of your neighbor as an angry crocodile. You don't want an angry crocodile as your friend, no? But you, at least you know why people are like that. It's because they're hurting themselves. And you can't be friends and with everybody. I've realized that in my life as well. You think if I'm just nice to that person, then we can be friends. But some people are just not... Yeah, they just don't want to be friends. I don't know why. I don't know why some people don't want to be friends with me. I don't know why some people don't want to be friends with you. But it's just the case. And for some reason it happens to be that those people are always your neighbors. Yep. I know people who are friends with everybody except for their neighbors. Maybe you're living too close to one another or something like that. It's just the way it is. And it makes you feel uncomfortable, you say, that she hates you. But this is the thing. That's why I told the story of the angry crocodile. Don't take that personally. Yeah? It's nothing to do with you. It's just... all to do with them. In the Netherlands, you have this. I haven't watched that for ages, but you had this TV show, and it was called The Judge on Wheels. So there was like a judge who went by car, and he always settled disputes between neighbors about the location of the fence and the noise coming from the radio and that sort of stuff. Crazy. And then they always neighbors fighting. So that's why she hates you, just because you live next door, that's why. What is the source in the suttas for the imagination visualization that you mentioned in your initial talk? I said already. Majjhima Nikaya 121. I took my creative liberty with it, but... the basic idea is the same, meditation on emptiness. Dear Venerable, can you speak a little bit about kasina meditation? Is this a kind of practice okay to do in addition to other daily meditations? Thanks and metta. Okay, so this word might not be familiar to some of you, but kasina is in the commentarial literature. They talk about meditating on like some physical disc. Let's say this was a physical disc, and you look at it and try to recreate that disc in your mind. That idea is not found in the suttas, though, in the early Buddhist texts. The word kasina is found there, but in the early Buddhist texts, as I understand them, and as also Venerable Sujato understands them, the word kasina is actually a synonym for what we nowadays call the nimittas. Because they talk about limitless lights, seeing them in your meditation, and those lights are called kasinas in the suttas. So the type of kasina meditation I would recommend is the type of the suttas, which are the nimittas. The one from the commentaries with those physical discs and stuff, I've never tried, but I don't know about that, but because it's not described by the Buddha, I'm not inspired to even try it. You might give it a shot, but I can't really help you with that any further. Yeah. But it's actually, once you start reading those suttas about casinas as being a synonym for the nimittas, this is all a bit technical, but some of you understand what I'm saying. There's actually a lot more evidence for nimittas in the suttas than some people think. There's people say that they are not described in the suttas at all, but they're just not called nimittas in the suttas. They're just called differently. But if you read those texts on those lights and colors, it talks about like seeing beautiful color blue, for example, like a beautiful flower, and give the flower a name and stuff. But this is, to me, clearly describing those lights that are possible to see inside of your meditation. If your meditation goes deeper, the lights we nowadays call nimittas, in the Buddha's time were called differently. There's a number of other suttas that speak about it as well. If you put them side by side and study the words that are used, it's actually quite clear that those casinas in the Buddha's days were those nimittas we call now. What led you to write your new amazing book? Highly recommend it. See over. Bazinga, it says. Okay, this Bazinga. This is an inside joke between me and Venerable Metaji. For years we have been hiding the word Bazinga everywhere, like underneath his keyboard I put a letter with the word Bazinga. This comes from a TV show called, what's it called again? Big Bang Theory. And there's this guy in there who also always says Bazinga after he makes a joke. And me and Venerable Metaji just started saying that word after every joke, and at some point that just became an inside joke between the two of us. So he read a new book that I have written about dependent origination, and it's called Seeds. Oh, no, I forgot my own title. I made it too complicated. Seeds, paintings, and a beam of light, similes for dependent arising. And I wrote that book basically because somebody asked me to. And to sort of clarify what those similes about dependent origination in the suttas are about, because they're sometimes misunderstood. And that's why I wrote that book. It's for free, available on the BBSWA website and other places. So you can just Google seeds, paintings, and a beam of light, or just Sunyo and seeds or something like that, and I'm sure you'll find it. And I'm not going to explain right now what that book is about. It took me years to write. I'm so slow writing. But I don't mind. I just, from time to time, and just when I felt like it, I wrote a little bit, then left it for months again. And I wrote a little bit again. But I'm pretty happy with it. I even made some drawings as well. Have you seen it? No. Okay, I'll show it to you. Is consciousness inside space, or is space inside consciousness? Or neither? Is it something useful to contemplate? Many things. So I think you're sort of asking, is the mind inside of the world, external world, or is the external world inside of the mind, or neither? Is it something useful to contemplate? In the Buddha's days, many people had all sorts of theories about the physical makeup of the world. And in the Buddha's days, if you were like a scientist in those days, if you had theories about the external world, you were also religious. Religion and science were not separate. So if you had theories about a soul, then you had to somehow also have a theory about the world. The two always went together. But the Buddha said, forget about all of that kind of philosophizing. What matters is just this mind and body. And don't try and contemplate how that external world works, how space works and stuff. So contemplate this mind and body. Stay with that. Dear Venerable, when a loved one dies and you are grieving for that person, how is it possible to stay focused on the present when memories are constantly resurfacing? Now, it's very similar to a question we had yesterday about the person's mother passing away. Then I gave some advice on how to overcome grief and why it's just nature of people to die and how we can move on. But maybe sometimes it's too early to move on and you're still in that grieving period. And I've never done this myself, but something that just came up in the moment, and you just have to give it a shot and maybe tell me later whether this works or not. But maybe you can try to make a deal with yourself. In this meditation, I don't need to grieve. I can grieve later. You got all the time later to think about the loved ones that passed away. But right now, it's not the right time. Right now, I'll just stay in the present moment. And then later, it's time to grieve again. And I think that will work, because I do the same thing sometimes when I have something to do or something to think about. Even as monastics, we sometimes have things to plan or do. For example, Venerable Ananda and me at one point had to do a lot of work for the visas for some of the monks, because we're from abroad. Then to get into Australia, pretty difficult, especially when you don't make any money. And you really have to convince the government that monastics are worthwhile to have in Australia, even though they don't make any money and don't pay any taxes. So, so that's a lot of thinking we have to do and a lot of communication. And sometimes you might go back to your hut to meditate and you still have that energy in your mind to think about that sort of stuff. Oh, how am I going to write this case? And I have to write this whole business case, they call it, to the immigration department, like pages upon pages, and sometimes you can get really stuck in that kind of mindset. But what I then do is decide when I sit down to meditate, this is not the right time to think about that. Right now, I'm just meditating. Tomorrow, when I go back to the office, then is the proper time to think about that, not right now. And if you make that deal with yourself, wow, you become also so much more effective at doing that job when it is actually time to do it, because you've like gathered all this good energy. You gathered this mindfulness. When I was doing my master thesis in university, I have many of these stories about being a student and very little stories about being a working layperson, because I ordained basically straight out of university. So, but when I was doing my master thesis, I, at some point, every day I got home, I was thinking about, I was designing this little machine. I did like precision engineering, so I was making this machine that had to move like 1 nanometer on like some magnetic stuff. Okay, I won't go into that details, but it was so involved, and I think so much whole day in university that on the train ride home and even being at home, I was always thinking about this, about this machine, and I realized I got more tired and more exhausted as my project went. And at some point I realized, this is not working. I'm just going to get burned out or something like this. So what I decided was, at some point I just did my usual thing, like, okay, I'm not going to think about it at home. But that wasn't enough. It didn't work. I decided to use a physical boundary. And what I did, my university, in the Netherlands there's a lot of canals everywhere. I don't know if any of you have ever been there, but they're all over the place. And my university also is surrounded by big canals. And every day, walking to the train station from university, I had to cross this canal. over a bridge. And I decided my master thesis and all the thoughts belonging to it stay on the university side of the canal. Whenever I cross the canal, they are unable to come with me. So when I cross the canal, they stay behind. And I travel from there to home. And when I come back again the next day, then I can pick up those thoughts again when I cross the canal, but not before. And that worked surprisingly well. It was, wow, really, really excellent thing to actually do. And I realized sometimes also I use that as a monk as well. Like, I have to do some work in the office, but when I walk back to my hut, once I cross the threshold of the office, all the office work stays inside the office. And you can do the same with your thoughts about your loved ones. Leave them behind somewhere to pick up again later. They'll be there again when it's time. But maybe like when you walk into the hall, you leave your thoughts outside of the hall. Same for everybody else who is struggling with certain thoughts. Just leave them outside. When you walk outside of the hall again, you pick them up again. Or you might even just walk outside of the boundary of Jhana Grove, leave your thoughts there and come back again. So when you leave this retreat, then you can pick them up again. And it sounds silly, but this physical boundary actually does work. Thanks for all the teachings. What is suffering for you? What if in the present moment there is grief? Three times the same question. I told you earlier today that all people are all the same. Is it by being present with it that it gets released with no attachment to the story that created it? Grief can have multiple causes. I assumed grieving for loved ones. So I will not get into that grief question again, but what is suffering for you? Well, I would ask that back to you. What is suffering for you? Because it doesn't really matter what suffering is for me, because we have to investigate our own experience and what makes us suffer. It is very useless to know what makes me suffer, because that might not be the thing that makes you suffer. So in your meditation here, what is suffering for you? What is suffering? Is it suffering to control your meditation, to demand things of your meditation? I think that is a lot of suffering. And it's much less suffering if we just leave things be. And as I taught you the guided meditation this afternoon, if we allow our meditation to suck, basically, if we allow it to be bad, then it's much easier to meditate because we let go. Dear Venerable Sunyo, can you share some methods or techniques as to how to let go of the body when meditating? Thank you very much. Okay, so when meditating, it's so peaceful when the body starts disappearing. And at some point, that actually becomes necessary for your body to start disappearing, because you can't sit, in my experience, for hours being aware of your body. It will just become painful. It's just the nature of the body. If you sit still for a long time and you focus on it as well all the time, in my experience, it will become painful. Maybe some of you have had some other experiences, but I think that is probably the general experience that you've had as well. In certain styles of teachings, they sort of semi-encourage that. And they say, just stay with the painful feelings and see them arising and passing away, or something like that. And Ajahn Brahm says, it's called anapanasati, not anapenasati. So, just watching painful feelings in the body in my experience, has, if it can be avoided, has very little value. So how do we get away from the body? One thing is to make the object of meditation for this meditation retreat that has largely been the breath, but it could also be like the feeling of metta or compassion or just peace or quiet in the mind. Make that object more important and more valuable than your body. We are attached to our body. We think if we leave it behind, something will go wrong. It might, start even hurting even more. We think we have to control it. I say we think, but it's like not a voice in your head, but it's like this feeling that we have to always focus on our body to keep it safe. But instead, convince yourself that your body will be perfectly fine if you let it go, and you can let it go, and you can actively steer your mind to focus on itself, to focus on the joy, or to focus on the breath and leave the rest of the body behind. You can encourage that. The deeper meditation goes, the deeper you need to let go of all control, and the more important it becomes to just be and don't do anything. But when the meditation is still in these kind of stages where you feel your body and you're developing the joy, or for example, you're with your breath, but it doesn't become joyful, you can still like encourage it in a certain direction. And when you get to the nimittas, if then you start encouraging things, you have to be really, really careful because you might just destroy that nimitta by doing that. But in the earlier stages, something's very helpful to know what direction you're going and help your mind in that direction. Skillfully, not with desire to go in that direction, but by having experienced those things before and know which is the right route to take and which is the wrong route to take. This is also satipatthana, knowing where to direct the mind and where not to direct the mind. Oh yeah, this was the question that I had before. Please tell us a little bit about your journey to become a Buddhist monk, but I think I told so many stories about my life already that that's sort of answered already. And as I said, boring anyway. It is, by the way, the most common question in the whole of Buddhism. Why did you become a monk? Or why did you become a nun? Very boring. I don't know. How do you apply calmness to a future you are angry at? Why are you angry at the future? Maybe that future you're angry at is never going to happen. As I said, as my Italian friend said, life is unpredictable. Remember that, life is unpredictable. Yes, you try to make a pasta, but it turns out pizza. I don't know. The way I cooked that would probably happen, but you don't know what the future is going to bring. And sometimes the future seems so certain. And that's why you're angry at it, because you think you know what's going to happen. The only thing you can know that's going to happen is you're going to die. If you're angry at that, I don't know why, because it's just the nature of life. But you're probably angry at something else, something more imagined, that's just in your mind. So how to let go of that anger? The usual technique to overcome anger is to practice loving kindness. I haven't really taught at this retreat. I gave a retreat about loving kindness a while ago, just a weekend retreat all on loving kindness. But in this case, if you're angry to the future, another way to overcome would be to just contemplate uncertainty, the uncertainty of life. We think we know exactly what's going to happen, but it's never like that. And a couple months ago, I was staying in the Cambodian temple in Kelmscott. And it's really nice to stay there because it's a very small community. It's also nice to stay in a big community, if everyone. When you're in a small community, the nice thing is also very few people coming to offer you food, so you're a bit closer to them. When in Bodhinyana, so many people come to offer the food, you just walk by and they put food in your bowl and you don't really see them, but over there, they sit right in front of you and you do the blessing, you can have a little chat. And one day, this family came with two little sons. They might have been twins, but they were all dressed in Batman suits. With the bat logo and even the ears. Yeah? And before lunch, the mother, she asked me, "Oh, can you talk to my sons after lunch? Just teach them a little bit about Buddhism." I thought, "Oh yeah, sounds like a good idea. Just come back after lunch and I'll talk to them. I can do that. I'm not very good with kids, I think, but I can try that." No, I didn't say that, but then during lunch, I was thinking, how can I teach those kids? Because I have got this feeling that I'm not good with kids, so I better prepare something to say about Buddhism. They were wearing this Batman suit. What if I say, like, Batman fights all the evil in the world, and the Buddha is like a bad man because he wants people to be good and not do bad things. So I had this whole story prepared, including the Joker and everything. And after lunch, they came, the boys, and they came and sit in front of me, and the mother said, "Hey, can you teach?" I said, "Yes, of course." "Do you both like Batman?" was my first question. "No, we like Pokemon." Okay, so the future is unpredictable. That's what I'm saying. And probably especially with children, but even without children, the future you can't predict. So I learned a good lesson then. I'll never try to prepare something like that again. I should have just enjoyed my lunch and see what happened. So afterwards, we talked about Pokemon, and I didn't teach anything about Buddhism. We just talked about who is your favorite Pokemon and stuff like that. Well, I did try to teach about Buddhism, but they clearly weren't listening to that. They're only interested in those Pokemons. Yeah, crazy. How to deal with loneliness? I have begun to miss my loved ones terribly, and I need a big hug. Thank you, Bhante. Wow, it's only a 5-day retreat. And we're only like, three days in? You miss them already terribly. Why? Do you think they'll miss you as well? Might be. Maybe not, maybe. Loneliness is often, maybe not always, but often comes from not being content with ourselves, not happy with ourselves. And by that I mean we think we're not good enough. We need other people to validate us, other people to love us. But why can't we love ourselves? Yeah. And when the Buddha taught loving-kindness meditation, this is the way the commentaries teach loving-kindness meditation, is to start with sending loving-kindness to yourself and then spreading it to other people and then to the whole world and then finally to your enemies. But when we teach like that, often people find it very difficult to start with themselves because they don't love themselves. And that's why we usually start with somebody else instead and don't follow exactly the way of the commentaries. But why can't we love ourselves? Why is that so difficult? When I was in my relationship that I mentioned earlier, one time I said something really stupid, but I was always honest, and I did say the honest thing, and I don't know exactly what my back then girlfriend asked, but my answer was that I am my best friend. And she wanted her to be my best friend. But I'm always 100% of the time with myself. So why shouldn't I make friends with myself? Wherever you go, there you are. I think that's another quote from Thich Nhat Hanh. Wherever you go, there you are. You're always with yourself. Forget about the Buddhist concept of non-self for a moment. I just mean self in the like ordinary way of speaking. We could change that quote. Wherever you are, there you are not. Wow. Mind is blown. No. Nice and peaceful. That's all right. So what was I saying? Yeah, find love for yourself. Then you'll be less lonely. And the way to do that is actively practice loving kindness towards yourself. And maybe you have to start that loving kindness by sending it to others, and then also start sending it towards yourself. And just realize that you are good enough. You don't really need the company of others to be validated or to be loved. You can love yourself. Dear Venerable Sunyo, so far no snake bites at Jhana Grove 2. I think with Metta Burr. Oh, please don't mention my name, said in brackets. Then don't write your name. I just read it out with Metta. Well, you've already heard it. Please don't mention my name here. Okay, I think she's just informing us that in all the years Jhana Grove has been here, no snake bites have occurred, so there's no need to fear. Going pretty quick. Dear Venerable Sunyo, any tips on how to let go of fear of death? Thanks. Yes, I do. Fear of death. When I was getting into meditation, I got into meditation not because I was a Buddhist, but because I just wanted to find more calm in my life. And for many people, it will be the same. And as I listened to talks about meditation, at first I heard also sometimes concept of rebirth mentioned, and I thought, silly stuff, you know. I was like what they call a materialist, or somebody who thinks that one life is all you have. And I thought all these religious ideas are silly. But I thought Ajahn Brahm's meditation teachings were pretty cool and very helpful for me, so I started following his meditation teachings. And over time, through my own practice, I got convinced about rebirth. And if you are convinced about rebirth, then death becomes a lot less scary, because you know there will be another life. And if you're a good person, then that other life will be in a good place. However, if you're not convinced of rebirth, then you might not have that consolation, like I didn't used to have it when I first started practicing Buddhism. And for a long time in my life, I didn't have that consolation. So when I did meditation on death, which I did as well when I was a materialist, I imagined what it would be like to die and to not exist. That was my idea of what happened after death. And in the beginning, it was really scary to contemplate not existing. But as I did it more and more, it's not so bad, actually, because you're not there to suffer either, you know. And if you can, it's scary, but if you can contemplate like that, either rebirth, or if you're more like materialistic, contemplate not existing, not so bad. You're all very quiet. Sounds maybe the penny isn't dropping for you yet, but try that. is actually, death is one of those other things that uncertainty is more frightening than death itself. We don't know what's going to happen. Yeah. So if you just prepare for various possibilities that you might envision, it should be okay. Venerable Sunyo, can you, so actually to just answer in short, contemplate death more, actually. That's the short answer. However, that is applicable to you. It might be scary, but it's actually, because it's scary, you contemplate it. And every time you contemplate it, remember frying pan, egg, first, stay in the middle for a long time, which is like the peaceful zone. And then slowly you can, if you want to, go into the new zone, the slightly uncomfortable zone. It's the same with contemplating death. You make sure you're peaceful and calm through meditation, and then you can think about death if you want to. And you get more used to the idea, and it will scare you less and less every time you do it. Venerable Sunyo, could you please talk about non-self? Is this an insight that develops only from deep meditation? Yes. Or are these practices, reflections we can do to gain some insight? Yes. And make deep meditation easier? Yes. I'm very hesitant to teach teachings of anatta during what is supposed to be sort of like a beginner's meditation. But even for if this was an advanced meditation retreat, I would probably not mention it much. And you've already noted that I've not mentioned it much, and I haven't given you like too much direct anatta, non-self teachings to do meditation. And the reason is, as long as you haven't seen it through deep insight, you'll always misunderstand it. And you'll feel like, I don't have an I. The self doesn't have a self. The Buddha describes all these things. And he called it improper attention. Ayoniso manasikara in Pali. And when people contemplate non-self too early, it almost always turns into improper attention or improper focus, inappropriate focus, however you would like to translate that. And it can be very disorienting for people. And actually a lot of problems can come out of that if you do that too much in your meditation. And you can become very, how do they call that? Dissociated in an unhealthy way. So I'm a bit hesitant to teach that. In my experience, the best time to contemplate non-self is after a jhana, because then your mind is powerful and it can take whatever whatever you bring to it to contemplate. And in the jhanas, the sense of self is also completely gone. That's the first time in your meditation that the sense of self has gone. And you can really only contemplate the absence of something after you've abandoned it. If the sense of self is there all the time in your meditation, if you feel like you are the doer in meditation, if you feel like you are the observer, then you can't contemplate properly what the Buddha was on about. But maybe I'll talk a little bit about it, maybe tomorrow or in another retreat one day, in a more, in a way that is appropriate maybe for meditation as well, as long as you hadn't gone that deep yet. Dear Venerable Nibbida, that's a Pali word for like being disillusioned with things or disenchanted with things, even like being put off by things. Seems contradictory to the teachings to see the good or beauty in things. Sometimes when reflecting, I'm just bringing up ill will. How is nibbida different? I'm suspecting acceptance is somehow involved somewhere, but the pieces aren't fitting together yet. Thank you. Yeah, nibbida is one of those other deep concepts, and it's actually only stream winners who really have nibbida properly. But nibbida is like turning away from things, turning away from life, even turning away from beauty. But that doesn't mean you have ill will towards beauty. It just means you see that even deep states of happiness are still suffering in compared to nirvana. And they're still not the deepest peace. I said before, in this meditation we go deeper into peace, deeper inwards, dropping more stuff from our awareness, going more peaceful and more peaceful. And as the mind gets more peaceful, it, as I said, it drops things from awareness. They're no longer interested to the mind. And through that you can learn that those things you drop, because by dropping them you find more peace, you can learn that the presence of those things was suffering. It's a very deep concept, but people ask these deep questions, so I might as well answer that. And when your mind drops everything, including itself, then everything disappears. And then you found the deepest peace, peace of nirvana, of extinguishment. And then you realize that in comparison, all the rest is suffering, because the deepest peace is to let go of everything. And that is when you get real nibbida towards those things. And you don't see the value in it anymore. That's a good way to think about nibbida. Imagine it as it was anymore. And you can't really force nibbida. Maybe that's the right answer to your question. Like, it sounds like you're trying to purposefully create nibbida, but nibbida is a result of insight. And the Buddha said, seeing things as they really are, that leads to nibbida. And nibbida is not something you actively create in your meditation, because if you do, then exactly, it'll turn into ill will. Why did you become a monk in this tradition and not in Plum Village tradition? So Plum Village is the tradition from Thich Nhat Hanh. And why I ordained here is because I thought Ajahn Brahm was the best teacher for me. His teachings, I felt, went deeper, and his jokes are a little bit better. No, I don't know. Actually, they're pretty bad, actually. I practiced in the Thich Nhat Hanh tradition, actually, mainly because the tradition is very big in Europe. And if there would be an Ajahn Brahm tradition in the Netherlands, I would have followed that, because, or something similar to that. But at the time, there were no monasteries in the Netherlands. There are now, actually, but there were no monks there. And there were just these lay societies. So I just visited a couple of lay societies. And I thought the one of Thich Nhat Hanh fitted me the most, because also it was a youth society, so people of my age to relate to. It's really nice. And but I practiced in that tradition a lot, but my meditation teachings I got from the start, I got from Ajahn Brahm mainly through the YouTube. Actually, already before YouTube existed, they had the talks on the BSWA website. That's where I used to get them from at that time. And that's why I started following. I think that's good karma. Dear Venerable, it seems, this is a thing, When everybody starts calling you venerable, then you also start calling yourself venerable sometimes. Like when people ask, what's your name? I say, I'm Venerable Sunyo, but I don't want to call myself venerable because it sounds a bit like a highfalutin, like, oh, I'm venerable, venerable so-and-so, please bow down to me, adore me. Anyway, I think I've even earlier in the retreat called myself Venerable Sunyo, but usually I just try to call myself Sunyo. That has nothing to do with the question, though. It seems that every time when my body starts to relax, my nose starts running like a slow-moving stream. I accept it, but I can't ignore it. What should I do or not do? Thank you. Sometimes when I meditate and my neighbor is noisy, I put in earplugs. And maybe you should put them in your nose instead. You know those things that you do? And then it starts streaming? Stop streaming. Yeah, maybe do that. Maybe it's just a temporary thing. Maybe you just have an allergy for a while. And yeah, if you let it go, then you'll get a lot of snot. But if you brought multiple pairs of clothing, and we've got a washing machine here as well, then it doesn't matter. One time I was practicing meditation with that Thich Nhat Hanh group, actually. And we used to do various events. And this time, everybody brought some food to eat. And we were going to eat that together. So I think I got some Turkish rice in leaves or something. And people brought all sorts of nice food. And they set all the food out in the middle, and then all we sit around it to meditate. And you sit there, and you smell all that food. So much saliva. Crazy. So much. I was constantly swallowing. So annoying. And I couldn't find any peace whatsoever. I thought, this is really unwise. Then I thought, whatever, you know, I'm just going to let it go. My meditation is more important than a clean shirt. So I just let it all go. And wow, that meditation, I really let go. Wow, that was crazy. Sometimes in the suttas you read these stories of people, they just see like a candle puffing out and then they suddenly let go. Something like that for me. I really let go. And wow, crazy. Such a peaceful meditation. Just because I let that saliva just follow the way of nature. And afterwards, when we came out of the meditation, I told all those people about it and they looked at me like this. I thought it was crazy, but I was very wise, actually. So maybe do the same with your snot. Hello, if you haven't already, can you please talk about sensual desire? I haven't, but I'll do that tomorrow. So we can finish all the hindrances. Very often, after a certain length of time sitting in meditation, I find heat being generated in my body, even begin to sweat. Could you account for such a phenomena? Yes, it's been like 44 degrees. I've had the same. Wow. Ooh. Sweat like crazy. No, okay, that's not what you're asking. You would have known the answer in that case. Often that is a case, could be of your body trying to maybe heal something inside. Could be. Your body is getting peaceful and it sees I've got an opportunity to maybe heal some sort of sickness, and it might be generating heat because of that. Could be the case. That's actually, I have not really verified that ever for myself, but that is what Ajahn Brahm often answers to these kind of questions. So I just take that on faith from my teacher. I always try to be honest about what I know and what I don't know, so, but this is what Ajahn Brahm says. So that could be the case. It might also be that you were always hot already and now you just have the time to notice. Your body was already warm from the start, but now you settle down and you actually start to realize how warm it is. What I have learned, though, is you've got much more control over your body and your body temperature than you think you might have. In Tibetan tradition, even, some places they teach monks to heat up their body because they live in a very cold climate. And if you want to graduate as a monk in some traditions, then the graduation ceremony is at the coldest night of the year. You have to sit outside with this wet blanket around you and heat it up by using only your mind. And there is also a Dutch man called the Ice Man. Some of you are nodding, you know him. And he also, science has proven by measuring that he can heat up his body just by using his mind and thinking about it. And you can also cool it down. And that is possible to do, actually. But it might not be the best way to spend your time meditating. But at some point, you might find that you can turn down the thermostat of your body. Like, turn down the amount of heat it generates. Maybe take some cold showers as well. Well, actually, I turned on the tap the other day and the water coming out, even off the cold tap, was boiling up hot almost. But maybe try to take some cold showers whenever you can. Let me see. A few short ones. I have a question about the connection of body and mind. We practice a lot what to do, not to do, with the mind, but what about the body? Do you agree to healthy body, healthy mind? Exercise? Well, I think a healthy body helps sustain a healthy mind, but if you have an unhealthy body, you can still have a healthy mind. I think I mentioned before, I realize if I sit too much meditation and don't do any exercise whatsoever, I get sick and I don't feel as much energy. I feel lethargic easily. So I try to do some exercise from time to time, not like crazy amounts, but just enough to keep healthy. And one of the reasons for me walking back to my hut every day was not just so I can sleep on my own bed, but also so I don't have a choice. I have at least to get like 40 minutes of walking every day, because it's like 20 minutes one way, 20 minutes back. So at least I get always that exercise. And I do it in the morning and the evening. So I would definitely encourage doing something like that in your daily life. Maybe not necessary in this retreat per se, but keep your body healthy through exercise and eating well. It will help your meditation a lot, in my experience. Let me see, let me count. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Let me pick a short one. Do that one tomorrow. Still got one more session. Dear Bhante, what causes internal chatter? What can be done to minimize it occurring? There's various things that can be done, but what causes most of the internal chatter is discontent. Not being happy with the present moment. We want to be somewhere else. So we start thinking about somewhere else. And if you're just here, happy with the moment as it is, it already takes away so much of the thoughts. There's no more need for thoughts about the future or the past. I've said that many times, but I keep repeating it because it's something that is very, very true and something that you don't just realize once, but you keep re-realizing every time you find that peace inside. And I've re-realized it myself many times. That's why I just keep restating it as well. Sometimes also we can think, because that's just what we're used to doing. We are thinking a lot during the day. Maybe you have a job that requires a lot of thinking. Or maybe you, outside of meditation, that's just your default mode of being. You go through life always thinking about things. And then, of course, you sit down to meditate. That energy is still there. You can't just flick a switch and demand that all those usual patterns that you have in your mind suddenly stop. The Buddha said, whatever you often think about, that becomes the inclination of your mind. Somewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya, literal quote. What you often think about becomes an inclination of your mind. If you often think about a certain topic, you sit down to meditate, surprise, surprise, you're going to still think about it. It's the way the mind works. So what we can do is also minimize thinking outside of meditation. Tomorrow, when you have your breakfast, when you have your lunch, I invite you to just eat and enjoy the food and see what it's like to eat and feel and taste and smell the food. You can even try it tonight with a cup of tea or whatever. Just drink the tea and enjoy the tea. It's another thing we used to do in that Thich Nhat Hanh tradition. I was like, I don't know what the name was, but like tea ceremony, just tea drinking. You just drink tea and that's it. No thinking about it. No planning for the future. And you just enjoy your daily activities without a need to comment on them all the time. Yeah. Often the thoughts in our mind are unnecessary. We know exactly what to do. You know how to drink a cup of tea. You know how to eat. But while you're eating, you're still thinking about all sorts of stuff. Sometimes even about eating itself. Oh, I'm going to go for that bite next. I'm too full. I'm going to take this and that. You're just commenting. It's like one of those sports commentators. Yeah? And he goes for the goal. And it's create more excitement if you just watch a football match, or what is it called, Australian football or whatever. What is this popular sport in Australia again? AFL, yeah, Australian Football League, I believe. If you watch that without commentary, it's less exciting. It becomes very boring, and that's why we think often. We want to make things more exciting, and we think that it's boring to just drink a cup of tea. It's actually not. It can be very pleasant and peaceful to just drink a cup of tea. So also in your life, go through things thinking less. Create that kind of sense of peace. Take it with you outside of your meditation. What you can do is, at the end of meditation, make a resolution. The peace I found, I'll keep with me as best as I can throughout the rest of the day, and especially during a meditation retreat. Maybe after this talk, go back to your hut and meditate for a couple minutes just to get your mind still again from all this banter I've been uttering, and then afterwards do that tea meditation. See if you can do that. And by doing that, we just in our whole lives we think less. And then it also becomes easier when we back to meditate to think less. So that's two things I mentioned. One is think less in life in general. The other is find more pleasure in the present moment. There's many other ways we can contemplate thoughts. I already mentioned earlier, and maybe I'll do again later, contemplating the downside of the thoughts. Where do they lead you? Have they ever fulfilled their promise? And if they did, thoughts about the future, if they turned out to be true, was you probably just a fluke. It's not because you thought about it and then things happened exactly the way you thought. It just happened to be the same way. Like when I thought about how to explain Buddhism to those kids, those were actually just useless thoughts, yeah, in the end. So that's how you can contemplate as well. One final thing before we leave, because this is such an important topic in meditation, is sometimes, and this is not necessary, but people are afraid of stopping the thinking. Afraid of the silence. Because when you stop thinking, it's like a part of you disappears. And it's like we are attached to that thought, because we think we are the thinker of the thoughts. And by thinking, we can control things we believe. If we just think about our meditation in the right way, then we'll be able to do it in the right way. But that's not true, as you might just find out after trying many, many times. Instead, put some more faith in stillness and peace, and don't be afraid of it. That's all I gotta say. All right, tomorrow a couple more, but we'll see about that then. Let us end by saying three sadhus to the Buddha and Dhamma Sangha. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Is that all you got? Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu.